Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. I am Bob Inyart, the pastor of Denver Bible Church. Earlier in the week, we had on this program Nick Britton, a former guest of the Bob Inyart Live TV show, and it was really great getting to be reacquainted with Nick, find out about his family, his wife, his children, and we ran out of time, so he agreed to stay with us. So, Nick Britton, welcome back to Bob Inyart Live.
Hey, how you doing, Bob?
Great, Nick. So, for those who didn't tune in, you were on this show 13 years ago. We did a few programs in studio on the TV show. And people who get the BEL televised classics, you show up in their on their living room TV every now and then, Nick.
I'm not sure how great a news that is.
Well, like you said, you know, we were young and teenagers. And, you know, the makeup that you wore, I wore makeup when I was in a rock and roll band in high school.
I'm going to have to try to track those pics down, Bob, because I cannot picture that. But
I hope you cannot track them down,
right.
Because it is embarrassing. But So we have similar experiences. So, Nick, we were talking about a worldview, and you said that where you're at, you tend to be agnostic, but you're not an atheist hiding under the label of agnostic. You're open to discussion about God and reality and all.
Oh, yeah.
So we ended up on a discussion about those who say, like existentialists, and those who say that we cannot even trust our own senses.
Right.
And I have seen it, and you could, I think you made a comment, but maybe you could repeat what you said. But I have gone to college campuses, and if I make a statement, they no longer say, can you prove that? They'll say, what right do you have to say that? And I'll ask them about truth, and they'll say, there is no such thing as truth. There's no such thing as right or wrong. And I try to get them to realize how they're exaggerating what they must truly believe. And so I say, there's no such thing as truth. Come on, let's have some middle ground. Let's start here. Do you exist? Do you exist? And they say, I don't know.
Right, and it's a nice thought experiment, you know, to question your own existence. I think that that's something you can do, and you can learn something from it, sure, you know, if you want to go through that process of questioning how do you know that you exist. And after a few minutes, then you should basically, you can come to the conclusion, as Sartre does, that I can't prove that I do, and then say, well, what am I going to do with that? Well, I basically have to act as if I can prove that I do exist,
yeah.
Or I can just kind of sit in the corner and rock back and forth.
And I think he's actually, so he's coming to at least a pragmatic result, but I think he's pulling a bit of an intellectual tantrum to say, I can't prove that I exist.
Yeah, and so
there's nothing wrong with the statement, I think, therefore I am.
Right.
I mean, I am self-aware. I have consciousness.
And you know, a lot of the, I was reading about the origins of the universe, and I was looking at the you know, the briefer history of time. I had the briefer version, not the brief version. And I, they said that the argument is that, you know, the Big Bang, you know, that at one point there was this inconceivably dense thing and then it blew up and what have you. And they say, and it brings up the question, well, what caused this dense particle to blow up into the universe? And the answer that the astrophysicists provide is, we don't know and we can't know, so we shouldn't bother asking.
Right.
Which... okay, you know, you're setting up a limit for yourself. You're saying you're not going to go beyond that point. Well, fine, you know, but you're making that assumption then that something did it, and then you're moving forward as if, I look at that as, you know, sure, I can't prove that I exist, but I have to move forward just as we have to move forward with the Big Bang or the scientists do.
All right, now, and I think your point was great, but I would have not added your last comment. I think it's great to point out that when they say that the Big Bang started this way, how do we know? We don't know. We can't know, but we are starting with that. I think that they do a disservice to millions of students when they don't admit that. They pretend that they have a scientific view of the origin of the universe, and that Christians have something that is far inferior, that we don't have a scientific view. That's a disservice. That's not intellectually honest.
They want to deny faith. And human beings, you know, as far as I've been able to determine, and, you know, I'm sure other people could, you know, register valid arguments against me, but as far as I can determine, human beings are faithful creatures.
Yeah.
And we have to make these assumptions. We have to, because our minds are limited. Our perceptions are limited. That doesn't mean they don't necessarily exist, but there are points where I just can't get my mind around it. And we all, different groups of people call it differently. You know, the Christians, you know, they conceive of God, who is beyond human comprehension, really. You know, I mean, a Christian can say, I know that God exists, but, okay, well, explain God. Well, you kind of run out of words after a while, you know, that...
Well, let's, if we could, every single topic you bring up fascinates me. And so when you said, you're pointing out that the cosmologists who say, well, it's the Big Bang, and we don't know how it started, and that's it's not valid for them to go on and pretend that they have the scientific view, that they have science to prove their view, and that creationists have something inferior. That's just not valid. They should be intellectually honest and say, we're believing in something we cannot explain scientifically and we don't have direct evidence for, but we believe it anyway. We have a philosophical commitment to this idea of the Big Bang. That's what they should say, and then that would at least be honest.
Well, yeah, and that's what, because we all, you know, they have their science. You know, they have their, what they call, you know, the Big Bang Theory, which requires that element of faith that they don't want to admit to. Very similar to what the Christian requirement of faith to believe in God, which also is, you know, if God was provable, then there's no faith anymore. You know, God necessarily has to be somewhat of a mystery, you know, in order to complete the religion, to complete the human journey.
Well, I don't know that I can agree with that, but I'm still trying to follow up on something you said. So you pointed out that the cosmologists are a bit disingenuous when they misrepresent what they believe.
It's like a little footnote that, oh yeah, we don't know, and then they
pretend they figured it out all scientifically, and if you don't agree with them, you're being uneducated, irrational, and unscientific. Well, then you said it's just like me. I can't prove that I exist, but I just move on. I disagree. I call that an intellectual tantrum. We can prove that we exist. It's possible I could be dreaming.
Right.
That is possible, because when people are asleep, they think they're fighting with their brother, and it's as real as could be, and they wake up, and they were not fighting with their brother.
Mm-hmm.
So it's super real. Or you could be on drugs. You could be on an operating table. You could be near death, and you're hallucinating. But you cannot be a figment of someone else's dream. That is irrational. That's not possible.
Yeah, and I like I said, you brought up Descartes. You know, I think therefore I am, and I think that's pretty valid. You know, that basically sums it up. That at that point we can move forward. We've had enough fun with the you know, intellectual.
Yeah, we've toyed with the idea. You know,
Descartes gave us the answer. You know, okay, we do exist now.
Yeah, Jesus said, if I testify concerning myself, now this is for people listening to him, and the question is, are they going to believe in him? Right? The first thing that college professors can't figure out anymore is if they exist. They don't even know that.
Right.
But then there's another question. How about this other person? Does this other person exist? And are his claims valid? Now, you can't ever get there if you don't even know you exist, or if you don't think truth exists, or right and wrong exists, then forget it. You're headed toward complete intellectual oblivion, if that's where you're at. And millions of our elitist intellectuals are there. But Jesus said this. He said, if I testify concerning myself, my testimony is not credible. This is in the Gospel of John. He said, but the scriptures speak of weighing the evidence, two or three witnesses. So he said, look at the evidence. He said, look at the scriptures, the prophecies that foretold of me. Look at the miracles I've done. Look at the voice from heaven that came down. This is my beloved son. Look at the testimony of John the Baptist. Look at all these different witnesses. And then you should see that my testimony is true. But only then. You need two or three witnesses. And that seems to be when people say, you know, first they said you can only believe what your five senses tell you. You've heard that, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you could only, and there, this is all a progression toward total ignorance. But when they said only you can only trust that which your five senses tell you, the way to refute that is to say, which of your five senses told you that?
Yeah, I saw it on your, I did some research on your website, and yeah, that's, we do have to, and it's, it seems, I sympathize, you know, with the, let's just call them the left, you know, that I sympathize with them. I feel that it's intuitive to want to control, you know, to want to say, you know, there can't be a God because if there's a God, then I'm not in control, or we need a socialist system because if the government's not in control of the economy, then who will be? You know, something needs to, that faith, that leap of faith scares them, you know, and they can't, and
Nick,
I feel for them.
I think that is extremely insightful what you've just said, that I want to be in control. If there is a God, then I'm not God, and I don't want to have any obligation to this being that I'm not comfortable with, so I'd rather take any intellectual commitment I have to take to give me a comfort zone so I can say there is no God. And so when we ask, is there truth? Does truth exist? And they say, no, there is no truth. There are no absolutes. There is no truth. How do you interpret that? Why are they saying that? I think you just answered it.
Yeah, because they are obsessed with their own, I guess, control with them, with themselves, that they
their own subjectivity,
right,
their own relativism. But also, if they admit that there's truth, then that opens the door. There may be a God of truth.
Mm-hmm.
There may be a source of all truth. There might be a reason why the universe is rational and not irrational.
And this is where things like socialism and affirmative action and things like that spring from, that because you know, this friend I was talking about in our last conversation, he we were talking about how they bus these schoolgirls around, and this was a few years ago in Seattle. They'd make them ride a bus for hours to get to the right school for their race. You know, they were Caucasian students, and so they have to go to a different school because of the percentages and all this and that. And I said, that's ridiculous, that, you know, they should just go to a, you know, that this is not a good system. You know, we can't have these kids waking up at 4 in the morning to ride a bus for a few hours. Mm. And he said, well, it's the government's job to make sure that every school correctly represents the demographics of its community.
That's just insane.
And how do we, and these are the same people who will complain that these socialists, these people that want to control the economy will complain, oh, the government's corrupt and these corporations are corrupt.
Right.
So their answer is to give the government more power.
More power. And
right,
these are the same people who will say that ATM fees are too high. We need to regulate the banks,
mm-hmm,
to lower ATM fees, but taxes are too low. We need to increase taxes.
Right, and it's, there has,
I mean, an ATM fee, you pay $3 once every 4 weeks, and taxes, you pay half of your income.
Right, it's, yeah, well, I think it was just, wasn't it just the other day Americans started working for themselves?
Yeah, right.
Something like the average American.
Tax Freedom Day.
And it's just, I like to look, you know, if you look at, say, a jungle, or you look at nature, and it just works, you know, that sometimes something, if something doesn't work, that animal doesn't exist anymore, that plant just, it's, conditions change, it doesn't work for that animal anymore.
Right.
You know, this condition, you know, you don't see a lot of elephants living in Canada, you know, because it's just not a good environment for them. If you released a bunch of elephants out there, they would have a hard time, or crocodiles living in Michigan or something like that.
Mm.
They find their niche and they prosper there. Nature just works. Now, when humans get involved and they start controlling it and fixing it and tinkering with it, they goof it up. You know, it's like the economy. The market will just work, and we don't want to let it work. But, you know, we want to control it. Well, what about this regulation? Well, we've got to control that fee.
Right,
we've got to raise
right.
this tax. And if we just trust, it will actually work out.
In the biblical worldview, what the government does is it enforces rights like do not murder, do not steal. So a company can't make profits because they're killing their competitors or because they're stealing from their customers. And so the government has a function in helping to enforce contracts. When people make an agreement and somebody works for 100 hours and their boss says, I'm not going to pay you, I don't feel like it. So there is a proper role for the government to enforce basic fundamental human rights, which are the backbone of a functioning economy, but that's it. The government doesn't manage the economy. The government becomes a drain on the economy, and everybody is poorer as a result.
And this is one thing that really bothers me, and sometimes I think a big problem we have is that we get so concerned with our labels that, you know, well, I'm this and I'm that. My wife was asking me, are we going to support the Tea Party, and what do you think about that? And I said, well, I bring up Animal House, you know, that it's just a matter of time before Napoleon from the Tea Party pops into the farmer's house. I mean, this is, I don't really trust them. They haven't really betrayed me yet.
Right.
I'm not going to start sending them money. Anybody who calls me asking for money, why? You know, it's...
And the Tea Party mostly is a movement of people who are upset about the way things are. And it's very difficult to congeal, like people who supported Ross Perot. That was before your time, right?
Oh, I remember Ross Perot.
Yeah, people supported Ross Perot, not because of what he stood for, but because they didn't like the two main parties. Mm-hmm. And the same thing is true with the Tea Party for the most part, and I believe. So it's easy to get a group of people together because they're upset at the status quo. It's very difficult to congeal that into something with an actual affirmative platform that could make a difference. Very difficult. Because as soon as the Tea Party leaders start saying, one says, well, now we have to ban abortion because rights come from God, and this is a child, and the second in influence and popularity in the whole Tea Party movement says, oh, no, you're not going to interfere with a woman's right to choose.
It's not politically expedient to make that claim.
Right, and so then you realize that the Tea Party is on what foundation? What is the foundation of the Tea Party? Is it a foundation of God-given rights and absolute moral principles? No, it's a foundation of we're angry. It's hard to take it to the next step. A couple things as we're going through this discussion. One of those, when you looked on our website, one of the cliches that I get a kick out of, I talk to materialists, and they think that there is only matter, that's it. And so they'll say that only the physical realm is real. Only the physical realm is real. There's no soul, spirit, and so on. I point out that, well, when you say only the physical realm is real, that claim itself is not physical. That claim is not physical. Ideas are not physical. They're not made up of matter. They don't have positive and negative charges to them. They don't have mass. And so the laws of logic and reason, even language, you study language and literature. The laws of language are real. And mathematics, the laws of mathematics are real, but none of these things are physical. They're not material.
There's this realm of thought. People get so concerned with, they decide, you know, I'm a conservative, or I'm a liberal, or I support the Tea Party, or I'm a libertarian, or whatever term it is that they come up with to define themselves. And then they go out, and they basically preach to the converted. And they say, you know, isn't conservatism great? And yeah, it's wonderful, it's spectacular. And well, I'm a libertarian, that's great too. And they find what they're looking for. They go out there and they look through the data and they read only the texts that support their view. And then they come away completely validated, of course, because they've never taken the time to challenge or think about things beyond what they already know, what they already believe.
Now, Nick, in my circle that I move in, say young earth, creationist, right-wing Christian Bible believers. When a book comes out promoting evolution or the Big Bang or there's TV programs or whatever, my circle of friends, we are attracted to that. We seek out the opposition to learn, to find out if they have anything new that we haven't considered. And we're interested. We want to engage. We want to debate. In my experience, the atheist and the evolutionist I interact with, they do not want to see the evidence on the other side. They they wouldn't read a creationist book if it meant their life.
Yeah, and I tell students whenever we, you know, I have to teach them about how to do research. You know, politics inevitably comes up, and, you know, there's politically charged TV channels and different websites that are politically charged. And I say, I go through it, and we talk about Adam Smith, and I bring up Karl Marx. And I say, some of you, you know, would say capitalism is a dirty word, and some of you say, oh, Marx is a Marxist. You know, he's an awful person. You're one of those loopy professors that teaches Marxism. And I say, no, I don't teach Marxism. I'm showing you the texts that are out there, and you should challenge yourself to look at these things. If your views can't stand up to a few pages of a book, then you need to get new views.
That's absolutely tremendous, Nick. When you said a moment ago there's this realm of thought, if you could walk with me through this progression of the ideas we've already discussed. They will say, a while back, they said, well, you can only know what your five senses tell you. And the obvious rebuttal to that is, well, which of your five senses told you that? Taste? Right. Your sense of taste? Did you lick the sentence and you knew it was true?
Right.
That you could only know what your five senses tell you. That statement is inherently, it's self-refuting, it's self-contradictory, because none of your five senses can tell you that you can only know what your five senses tell you. And you said there's this realm of thought. Well, once you become sort of a materialist, and you are teaching students, and we have this on video. We have a video. I went into a college philosophy class for an hour and 15 minutes, and I taught the class, and the philosophy teachers in the back of the room, and it was a trip. I'll tell you that, Nick. We call it Get Out of the Matrix.
All right.
And the teacher had taught the class, you can only know what your five senses tell you, and she taught it as though it was a settled fact of reality. And so I asked the class, which of your five senses told you that? And some of them chuckled, and they realized that it's inherently contradictory. She said, we never had that in our class. And one of the students picked up the handout, and he said, it's right here. I got it from last week. It says right here, you could only know that which your five senses tell you. But then go forward another 20 years with that being taught, and then we arrive at the existentialists that you've mentioned, that we can't trust our own senses. Now they think they can't trust their own senses. Now they don't know if they exist, and they don't think there's such a thing as truth, so that all this is based on an atheistic worldview, and I submit that atheism leads people to a place of total ignorance. You can't know if the earth revolves around the sun. You can't know what numbers add up to. You can't trust your senses. You don't know if you exist. You are utterly ignorant. You have arrived.
Yeah, there has to be, there's that zero point, right, where it's just nothing is knowable, nothing happens. What's interesting to me is I brought up in our last conversation, I brought up my friend who will tell me these things in his nice house on his nice cell phone and with his nice stuff. And then he'll say, you know, but we can't know anything, and the system is so corrupt, and what about the poor? And I'll say, well, how much time do you spend donating to charity? You know, how much money have you donated this year? Well, I'm going to, next week, I'm going to set up to do that. And say, but you know, you seem very happy with your you know, $40,000 SUV. You know, you seem very happy with this. Your senses are, you seem to know that you like it. You know, and, well, but that's different. And,
You mentioned the Big Bang, and there's the editor of Nature magazine, which is the mother load of the atheistic Big Bang worldview in the world, Nature magazine. And Maddox is his name. I think it's Tom Maddox. He retired, and he wrote a book called What Remains to Be Discovered. And he points out that we don't know what came first, stars or galaxies. And galaxies are made up of stars. And stars are these massive building blocks of the universe. They build galaxies. And so when he admits that Big Bang theory doesn't even inform them to know what came first, stars or galaxies, what that reveals is that when they tell millions of people that they have figured it all out and it's all scientific and they know how it happened, they're overselling their case.
Right. That's what so many of the, I hate to call them intellectuals, but because I kind of consider myself an intellectual. You know, I have my fancy books too and my degrees and all that stuff. But they and I like to rely on them and show them off and stuff. But they think that that we're right on the cusp of figuring it all out. That we're all going to have it all figured out tomorrow. Mm. One more experiment. And nobody wants to admit that we on the grand scheme of things, we know very little about anything.
Well, how about the moon, right? If we look at the moon, they have the most difficult time, they being physicists, astronomers, cosmologists, who come from an atheistic perspective. They have the most difficult time explaining how the moon got there. There are these completely contradictory primary theories. And they're completely contradictory because one or the other is true. And they do such a terrible job at explaining the evidence of the moon, that it actually is there and what the moon does and what it's like. That's why there's so many theories on how the moon might have got here. But Scientific American had a joke a few years back, and they said, we now could explain the moon. It's observational error. The moon does not exist. And they were joking.
Right.
But that highlights they don't even know how the moon got there, and they want us to believe that they know how the Andromeda galaxy got there and the whole universe and the solar system. So we're sold
6 billion years ago.
Right, right. You mentioned faith, Nick, and we're speaking with Nick Britton from the Midwest. He was a guest on the Bob in Your Life TV show 13 years ago. What a joy to reconnect with him. And Nick, the definition of faith in the Bible, in the New Testament, in the book of Hebrews, is faith is the evidence of things not seen. Faith is the evidence of things not seen. So we are very easily convinced in a force called gravity because we see the evidence, even though we can't see the gravity.
Right.
Same thing with electricity and so on. So we believe in all kinds of things we can't see based on the proper response to the evidence. So when you said earlier that human beings are creatures of faith, we tend to want to believe in something that explains our existence.
Mm-hmm.
What you're saying, the way I hear that, when you say those words, what I hear is human beings realize there is overwhelming evidence that there was a brilliant personal creator who made us. Therefore, we have religious beliefs because we see the evidence. And we know that when your child is born, and this precious child, in between you and your wife, if you're like my wife and I, we couldn't figure out how to attach one blade of hair to our child's head.
Right.
We couldn't put one eyelash on our son. And yet here comes this beautiful child, and we realize that there was a designer who made this child. And so, yeah, we are people of faith. Not meaning blind faith, but a proper response to the evidence. That's how I understand it.
Sure, I think that's reasonable. And it's just the people who don't want to admit that. To me, and you know, and being in the industry that I'm in, it's a highly charged political area, and I have to. I was asked by the paper the other day, you know, how do you feel about the healthcare plan? And I said, well, you've got a few minutes, and I explained, you know, how I didn't feel. And they wanted to know my employer. And I was very reluctant to tell them.
Wouldn't your employer be very tolerant and respectful of diverse views?
That's the problem, is that they claim that they are.
They claim, right. Their greatest value is tolerance. And I find that the beautiful people are not tolerant.
When I apply for promotions and it says, well, we're an equal opportunity employer, what I see is, I don't see what the difference between that and a Jim Crow law is. It might as well say white males need not apply, you know, or at least back of the line.
Right.
And that really bothers me that, well, for our quest for diversity, we're assuming that we don't believe in humans so much. We believe that humans are so weak and frail that we have to organize and protect these people. Mm. You know, that to me is racism, you know, to say the affirmative action. And
yeah, I agree with that. There's different forms of racism, but I agree completely with that. And it's the racism of low expectations.
Mm-hmm.
We expect that all these people are going to perform poorly, so we're going to cook the books, basically. Hey, a couple things, Nick. What's your time like? Do you have a few more minutes? I would love to talk to you more. Maybe we could do this again in a few weeks.
But yeah, that'd be great.
All right, super. But maybe we could talk about one topic before we conclude.
Right.
And just briefly, not an exhaustive discussion, and I didn't mention this to you in advance, so I don't want to catch you off guard, but the idea of evolution, and there are even theistic evolutionists, you know, who think that we've evolved, but then God put a soul in us. And then there are atheistic evolutionists who say, no, we just evolved. And so man came from some kind of a hominid, some type of an ape, and it evolved to us. And this happened over a few million years, a couple million years. Well, as I look at that, evolution, they tell us, happens so slowly that you can't see it. And the more we learn about DNA and genetics, we realize that there are millions of extraordinary differences between a chimp and a human being.
Right.
And if you look at our hand and the way a human being, you know, a chimp's hand, they could survive. They survive very well. A human being, our hand is so far beyond survival. You have concert pianists and people who assemble telescopes, and we can do
surgeons.
The most surgeons. We do the most extraordinary things with our hand. One of the most extraordinary physical designs known in the universe, the human hand. So far beyond what we would ever need to survive. So far beyond. And so you only have, if the evolutionists are right, to get from Australopithecus or Lucy or whoever to Homo sapiens, you only have a couple million years, but evolution is so slow, you can't see it happening, and one mutation in one gene has to work its way into the entire gene pool so that all us Homo sapiens are one race genetically, and that in and of itself would take thousands of generations. And so you need millions of changes all to occur together in just a couple million years. It is absolutely contradictory to think that that could happen. They're fundamental mathematical impossibilities that to me show that, no, that story can't be. We could not have come from chimps by survival of the fittest and natural selection over a couple million years.
Starts to sound pretty miraculous.
Yeah, right. The evolution sounds miraculous. Like the human brain, as best I've read, we have about 100 billion neurons, 100 billion, and each neuron has 1,000 connections so that we have 100 trillion connections in our brain, 100 trillion. Compare that to a chimpanzee. Our brains are so sophisticated, far beyond anything we would ever need to survive in the wild, far beyond, so that we could create spaceships that go to Mars.
Well, it's interesting that, you know, you take like Noam Chomsky, who's done a lot of work with language and evolution. It's not surprising to me that he then reveals himself to be socialist, you know, because he does have this incredible element of faith and this control aspect to his research. He's a titan in my industry. You know, of course, you can't even criticize Noam Chomsky. But
right. We did two shows on Noam Chomsky just recently, by the way.
Okay.
Maybe we could talk about those in a future program. But go ahead. So make your point. So he ends up being a socialist.
Yeah, and it's not surprising because he needs this. He can't just leave it up to – he doesn't want to leave it to chance, you know, because he can't. If he just leaves it to chance, then it's mathematically proven. So he has to have this, well, humans are different and isolated, but it still comes from these, it does start to get this loopy kind of argument, where essentially what he should just say is, look, we can't explain language. You know, either the research isn't there, or it is there and I just don't want to accept it. Can't explain language, they can't explain charity. And so they come up with these kind of bizarre things that seem to be, charity seems to be contradictory to evolution, though.
Well, charity, right, altruism, when you want to make sure that you reproduce. And so not only do we have organisms in a species that will sacrifice their lives and die for someone else, but we have 100 trillion cells in our body, and our cells go through this apoptosis where they program themselves to die. Cell death. And they announce that me as a cell, one of the cells in my body, I'm now going to die. They put out a chemical signal, and basically the cell is eaten, and it's recycled. And so, right, where does this stuff come from? You've heard of Edward, I don't know how to say his name, Sapir? Edward Sapir? Noam Chomsky?
Okay, I'm familiar with him. I haven't studied him as much.
But. Yeah, he's a linguist. And these guys basically, in Chomsky, in a lifetime of research, has proved Charles Darwin wrong. Mm-hmm. Darwin thought that some languages, like down at Tierra del Fuego, some languages are primitive. Well, now, after decades of exhaustive research, it's now stated clearly that there is no such thing as a primitive human language. There's no such thing. Also, it's stated, because some languages have a smaller vocabulary, but their rules of grammar and their tenses, they're as sophisticated as any language in Europe. And so that's one of the fruits of Chomsky's work. Secondly, where Darwin thought that the world would be filled with evidence of how language evolved, that's not true. I think you were pointing out, we could say that we don't know. How did language get here? And thirdly, that animal grunts can be shown to be steps toward language development. That has been disproved.
Oh, yeah. They've abandoned the research on the apes because there's just simply no correlation. There's no relationship. The apes have no language capacity.
You can have an animal that grows up alone, and the animal does all the grunts and calls and all.
Right, and there's nothing to be learned. There's no abstract thought. None of that.
Right.
So they've started looking at ants, and now that's the current research is that, well, ants demonstrate language, and that's where...
And I hope you don't mind if I chuckle, Nick.
No, and it just, you guys are starting to grasp at straws at this point.
That right.
What's wrong with I don't know? You know,
well, I don't know, and I think that I do know because I believe that the Bible is an accurate historical record. And so you go back a few thousand years ago, and you find an explosion of civilization in the Middle East. You find approximately 100 original language groups around the world, and those language groups appear suddenly, and they didn't come from tens of thousands of years of earlier evolution of language. They're just there. And when I add to that what we've learned from archaeologists and historians, and then genetic historians, Nick, it blows my mind that genetic historians are finding evidence that the story in the Bible is true. Mitochondrial Eve is dated to have existed about 6,000 years ago. Mitochondrial Eve, the first woman where all the mitochondrial DNA comes from, about 6,000 years ago, when you plug in actual known mutation rates of mitochondrial DNA. And then they find a bottleneck of X chromosomes, which is just stunning, and the dispersion of language around the world from the Middle East, I see the story of the Bible arising out of our greatest intellectual pursuits. There it is.
And I think that it has to do with that realm of thought that we were talking about where they want to ignore evidence. You know, and I remain the agnostic. I'm still weighing the evidence. You know, the jury's still out for me. But I don't like it when my peers have basically decided before they go into it that this is what they believe, you know, whatever theory it is. And they believe this. And they're going to disregard evidence that doesn't appeal to that. Because I've heard this discussion about mitochondrial Eve, and they choose the term Eve because, well, we can get our minds around that. People seem to know what that is. But they never once mention that, well, perhaps this is evidence for biblical history.
I mean, what we know is that unless our genetic science is wrong, and unless there were no mutations for a million years, what we know is the genetic diversity in mitochondria in the entire human race could be accounted for in 6,000 years of mutations.
Right.
That's what we know. So, yeah, people ignore that powerful, hard scientific evidence because of their worldview, not because of their commitment to follow the evidence. Hey, Nick, we're out of time. Let me ask you this. If you'd like to, I'd love to continue the conversation. Would you be open to me sending you a few resources, and you could either look at them or not as you're interested, And perhaps maybe, for example, those two shows on the origin of human language that we have on our website with Chomsky. You could just search for Chomsky at kgov.com. And maybe from that, you might find some things that interest you, and we'll take it from there.
Yeah, that'd be great. That'd be nice to really start digging into. You know, we seem to agree too much this time. It was kind of weird.
Yeah, definitely weird.
We can find something we can debate.
Actually, Nick, I think we really hit it off 13 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoyed meeting you, and we obviously had different opinions, but, you know, both had a desire to talk through and to learn and to think. So,
yeah.
All right. Well, let's do it. We'll send you, if it's okay, I'll ask our call screener to get your address.
Sure.
We'll send you a couple things, and maybe you could check out Chomsky on our two shows at KGov, and we'll take it from there.
Okay, excellent.
All right. Thank you, Nick Britton. What an enjoyable time talking through these issues with Nick after 13 years, young guy, 18 years old, comes on Bob and Yart Live, and that was after he showed up protesting, dressed as Marilyn Manson, of all people. I did a show where I took a banana and I put makeup on it, made it look like Marilyn Banana Manson. And we just had a good time on the Bob and Yart Live TV show. If you have not seen the BEL Televised Classics, you might want to get that. It is a lot of fun. Not only are the shows entertaining, you go home at night, you're tired, you want to watch something on TV, you got 300 channels, there's nothing to watch. Well, people make it part of their routine where they either get two BEL Classics a month, two shows, four shows, or eight shows, whatever they'd like, and they come in the mail on DVD, and they build their own library, and it's fun. It's entertaining, fascinating conversation, and you know what? It's like self-help, self-improvement, only it's not self, it's coming from God's Word, because the ideas that we express on Bob and Yart Live are what we read in God's Word, asking him to help me, to help us here, the staff at Bob and Yart Live, to study his word, meditate on it, understand it, and then teach it as he calls us to do. So you can call us 1-800-8-NYART, 1-800-836-9278, or you could go to our website, kgov.com, and I think you'll enjoy any of the resources we offer, but we have a simple money-back guarantee. It couldn't get more simple. 30-day money-back guarantee. That's it. And that's for our books, our DVDs, our Bible study albums. And that's hard to find, no? You go to a bookstore, you get a 30-day money-back guarantee if you don't like the book. I don't think you get that. Do they? Barnes & Noble, you get to return the book if you didn't like it? If you thought it was false? I don't think so. But at Bob and Yart Live, that's what we offer, and we have been very blessed by the input from thousands of people over the years for our resources. We also have, for the person who can't decide, we have what we call the NYART Library. The NYART Library has one of everything, and it is like going and getting a degree in a Christian worldview. If you get the NYART Library and just work it in your routine, watch a video once a week, listen to a Bible study album an hour or so a week here and there in the car, and read a chapter of one of our books now and then, and after a period of time, you will learn so much that you will have a renewed appreciation for God's Word, His creation, and then how to answer your friends and your family, your kids, your grandkids, when they ask you questions about life, about God, about reality. So thank you out there in the audience. Our website is kgov.com. Please check out at American Right to Life's website, the Dred Scott Shepherdization. It'll blow your mind. And Maranatha Christian Center, what a great school.